I'm Joanna Smith. Welcome to Transfeminist Critique of Mormon Theologies of Gender. We're really glad you joined us today. Come on in, sit close. Before we begin, we have a few announcements. We ask that cell phones are turned off and those attending be respectful and attentive. This session is being recorded and you'll be able to purchase it after the presentation ends up at the front. Concessions after this will be open for lunch, and you're welcome to visit local restaurants in the area, but come back by 1:45 for the next session. So that's kind of the timeline. This session is 60 minutes, and we ask that audience and presenters keep within the time frame. Kelly is going to do her presentation, and we'll have a Q&A after. So just know that we'll get to you, and we'd love to take your questions, but save it for the end until after she is able to give her presentation. I'm going to plug a reminder that Sunstone has a policy to keep our mind open and really respectful dialogue of things that stretch us. And so we want to remember that in all of our sessions that we go to. About this session... this is done by Kelly Potter. She's an associate professor of philosophy and associate director of religious studies at Utah Valley University. She's a founding member of the Society for Mormon Philosophy and Theology and has published articles in Faith and Philosophy, the International Journal of Philosophy of Religion, and Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought. In this paper, she presents a transfeminist standpoint, critique of Mormon's ideology of gender. Transfeminism attempts to address issues that arise from the intersection of sexism and cissexism. This standpoint critique involves two steps, and we'll give Kelly the mic so she can expand on that.
Thank you. Can you all hear me well enough? Okay. In this paper, I present a transfeminist standpoint epistemological critique of both orthodox and feminist theologies of gender in the LDS tradition. This is an application of the methodology of feminist standpoint theory, where in lieu of starting from the standpoint of women, we start from the standpoint of transgender individuals. To begin, we need to get clear about what standpoint theory is and how it can be applied in the context of religious belief. Standpoint theory originates in the Marxist philosophical tradition. In that tradition, one's standpoint in society determines how one perceives society. A standpoint is composed of the intersection of the various groups of which one is a member. So, for example, black women will have a different standpoint than both white women and black men. Not only does everyone have a standpoint that affects how they see the world, but some standpoints are dominant and others are marginalized. Those that occupy marginalized standpoints have the capacity to perceive things about society that are hidden from those that do not share their standpoint. To put it another way, dominant standpoints tend to obscure reality to the extent that the irrationality of its dominance would be manifest, while the marginalized standpoints possess a kind of epistemic privilege with respect to seeing the reality of society. It's not that they have an automatic ability to see things more objectively, it's that they occupy a position that is both inside and outside the institutional structures of society, and this gives them an advantage. Upon thoughtful reflection and collaboration with others that have also have a marginalized or dominated standpoint, those that occupy such standpoints can have a less partial view of society. They see it from the inside because they are members of the group, and they see it from the outside because they are dominated within the group. Many feminist academics have adopted a broadly standpoint approach. Clearly, women are uniquely placed to understand the reality of the gender regime and how it is used to dominate them. Examples of those that have taken this approach are Sandra Harding in her work in the philosophy of science and Pamela Sue Anderson in her work in the philosophy of religion. Feminist standpoint epistemology has come to involve a certain methodological approach. It is one that recognizes the embodied nature of the cognizing subject and incorporates this in its critique of the dominant epistemology. First, standpoint theory advocates that we interrogate the basic assumptions of the dominant conceptual scheme, showing to what extent it is based on arbitrary factors arising from the standpoint of those that dominate. Second, standpoint theory advocates that we build an alternative scheme from the standpoint of those that are marginalized. The goal of standpoint epistemology is to come to have a less partial viewpoint via a critique of the dominant standpoint. This is called strong objectivity. Pamela Sue Anderson describes it as follows. Strong objectivity is comprised of two main motives. First, the new subjects move outward to shift away from the privileged subject's standpoint, to think from the lives of others. Second, the subjects move backward, reflexively, to re-examine the basic background beliefs of their own originally privileged position as a subject of knowledge. The goal of these moves toward objectivity is not to achieve absolute truth nor impartial knowledge, but to gain less partial knowledge than the subject has from his or her privileged perspective on reality. Instead of justifying true belief and refuting skepticism in the manner of conventional epistemology, feminist epistemologists aim to gain knowledge by scrutinizing the credentials of knowledge claimants and putting knowledge claims under communal criticism from the perspective of an outsider. Now I turn to discuss what it means to call my argument a trans-feminist critique. First, let me introduce some terminology for those unfamiliar with transgender issues. Someone is transgender just in case they do not identify with the gender sex that they were assigned at birth. A transgender person is transsexual just in case they medically transition, which involves hormone replacement therapy, and sometimes various different types of surgeries, including, but not limited to, gender confirmation surgery. People that identify with the gender assigned them at birth are called cisgender, or usually just cis. Cissexism is the marginalization of and/or domination over transgender individuals. Transmisogyny is the double nature of a trans woman's oppression at the intersection of femininity and being trans. Not all transgender people identify as the other gender. Some identify as non-binary, that is, outside or between the usually mutually exclusive and collectively exhaustive male and female. The words transgender and trans are adjectives, not nouns or verbs. Finally, the term cishet refers to those who are both cisgender and heterosexual. Transfeminism attempts to address issues that arise from cissexism as well as from transmisogyny. Given the LDS Church's political activities regarding the LGBTQ community, including official church policies concerning transgender individuals, it is vitally important for transgender Mormons and their allies to develop a standpoint critique of Orthodox LDS theology. This standpoint critique will involve two steps. One, a critique of the dominant theological paradigm and practice, showing how it arbitrarily excludes the trans community. This is Anderson's moving backwards. And two, a presentation of an alternative theology that starts from the position of trans folk. This is Anderson's moving outward. So moving backward. Orthodox theology of gender is rooted in an extreme version of theistic anthropomorphism, which developed early on in the history of the movement. However, an explicit statement of the implications of this anthropomorphism for gender wasn't made by the church until the church released the Proclamation on the Family in 1995, I think. One striking claim in this document is that gender is eternal. This claim will sound odd to academic ears, since we're used to discussing gender as something that is, almost by definition, socially constructed. So what does this claim mean? It could mean that genders are objective and eternally existing universals. But this sounds a bit too Platonic for Mormon tastes. It seems more likely that it means that our spiritual essences or intelligences, which have always existed and will always exist, ha- have a sexed nature that doesn't change. Or perhaps it just means that one cannot change one's gender. It is important to notice the ambiguity in this claim, and I will return to it later. The proclamation, as it's now called, was released in the midst of a legal battle in Hawaii concerning gay marriage. The LDS Church played a significant role in that court case and needed explicit theology to justify their advocacy on political matters. One goal of the proclamation was to give a theological basis for rejecting the legalization of gay marriage. There were, of course, other goals for this document, but it is clear that the opposition to gay marriage was one of the main motivations. Let's consider how the justification runs. Human beings are gods in embryo, and part of being a god is being in a procreative, heterosexual, eternal marriage. So since being a god is the telos, or the purpose, of being human, and being a god requires being in a heterosexual union, homosexual marriage is contrary to the human telos. But why include the claim that gender is eternal? Well, if gender could change, then a heterosexual marriage could become a homosexual one, and vice versa. The line between the two would be blurred, and the LDS Church's opposition to gay marriage would be obviously arbitrary. Despite seemingly considering the possibility that gender could change, there is still a big loophole in the shape of a big T. A married man that holds the priesthood might come out as a trans woman. Or equally dangerous, I should have said, a married man that holds the priesthood might come out as a trans woman. Or equally dangerous from the standpoint of the leadership, a woman in the church might come out as a trans man and petition to be ordained to the priesthood. And to compound the problem, the existence of such people is not ruled out by the proclamation as it stands. To show this, I will turn to see the issue as a trans person might. In order to illustrate how a transfeminist interpretation of Mormon theology can emerge from within the tradition, I will consider the documentary film directed by Torben Bernhard called entitled Trans Mormon, that follows the coming out story of trans woman Ari Hayward, who was raised as a Mormon in Utah. In this short 15-minute film, we hear from Ari and her parents about their Mormonism and Ari's transgender journey. She talks about the pain and suffering she experienced being raised as the wrong gender, suffering that started very early in her life. Her dad tearfully relates the story of how Ari told them of her fantasy in which she would cut off her penis, hoping her parents would find her to take her to the hospital in time to save her life. Upon hearing this story, her father relates that he realized that he had to find help for her. Of course, the medical and therapeutic communities have discovered that the best way to help trans folk is to validate their identity and to help them medically transition if they so choose. And so these obviously orthodox parents made the decision to help Ari affirm her true self, including taking her to Thailand to get gender confirmation surgery. From the perspective of Ari and her family, the theology of the proclamation doesn't really exclude trans women and men, since Ari's spirit is obviously female, and eternally so, despite the gender mismatch with her male body. Indeed, in one scene, her dad describes how he would be surprised to arrive in the afterlife and see that Ari is male, since he's so firmly convinced that her spirit is female. Notice that this understanding is perfectly consistent with the second and more plausible interpretation of the claim that gender is eternal. In fact, it is even consistent with the third interpretation that claims that one's gender cannot change. Ari would say, most trans people would say, that their gender has not changed. She was female all along, even when she was forced to live as male. Nevertheless, despite this seeming coherence with the proclamation, LDS Church policy continues to exclude anyone that has undergone gender confirmation surgery from full participation in the church. They only focus on gender confirmation surgery and none of the other things that have to do with transitioning, which is an interesting omission. We see clearly that trans women and men raise a significant issue for Mormon practice, since the former's authenticity can be described in ways that fit perfectly into the Orthodox LDS narrative. In fact, the very idea that the spirit is gendered almost begs for the possibility of a mismatch with the biologically sexed body. And why wouldn't this be a possibility? Eri's father is an Orthodox Mormon, and his response to the dissonance caused by Eri's trans status is an Orthodox one. He would prefer that Eri be a trans woman interested in boys, and thus heterosexual, than a femme gay boy. But once we pull on the thread here, the whole theological fabric comes apart. For as mentioned above, once trans women and men are accepted, then some members' sexual relationships that were once sanctioned by the church, even ones that involved temple marriages, would suddenly become taboo. And these couples could easily protest that this change in the legitimacy of their relationships would be quite arbitrary. Hence, the arbitrariness of the church's heteronormative position would become obvious. Of course, the Orthodox believer might say, clearly, gender is eternal means that we all have the same gender in this life and that we had in the previous life. That is, it means that there cannot be a mismatch between the gender of one's spirit and one's body. If that's what it means, why not say that? At this point, the fact that the homophobic tail is wagging the theological dog becomes pretty obvious. It is quite clear that the proclamation could be interpreted to be consistent with someone's being transgender, and yet it is also clear that this is not how it's being interpreted in practice. Of course, in the LDS Church, there is an order to how things are done, an ecclesiastical hierarchy. And the people at the top get to interpret the texts. So Eri's father's understanding of the proclamation is trumped by the interpretation that is accepted by the brethren. So is Eri's. But think about what this means. Eri's testimony that she is a woman is trumped by the brethren's interpretation of the proclamation. Nothing can be more personal than one's sense of self. If there's anything for which one should be able to receive personal revelation, it would be one's self. And one's gender identity is certainly a component of one's self. So the LDS Church's current interpretation of the proclamation tells transgender members to deny our own subjective experiences. And yet, this is the church that tells us to accept our subjective feelings about the truthfulness of the gospel. Again, the arbitrariness of Orthodox LDS theology is manifest. LDS Orthodoxy doesn't find itself forced on by unequivocal revelation from God to reject transgender folk, and yet it continues to do so. So although it might seem that the theology of the proclamation does give an unequivocal endorsement of an anti-LGBTQ position, it doesn't. Why interpret the proclamation so as to exclude them unless it is motivated by a desire to exclude gays from marital relationships? Orthodox Mormons are not forced by their theology to reject gays and trans folk. Instead, they are forcing their theology to reject gays and trans folk. And they are doing a rather poor job of it. And this is why the standpoint of trans members is so important for the perception of the arbitrariness of the anti-queer agenda in LDS brand Mormonism. Moving outward. Interestingly, the theology developed from Eri's perspective is similar to the approach in Mormon feminist theology, which often accepts a broadly essentialist and binary approach to gender. However, I believe that the transfeminist perspective requires a more radical critique of Mormon orthodoxy. Eri's father grounds his acceptance of trans identities on a heterosexist theology, but it is easy to see how the fate of gays and the fate of transgender individuals are intertwined. Accepting the authenticity of the one provides strong grounds for accepting the authenticity of the other. On the other hand, Mormon feminism is based on more progressive tendencies. To see this, let's situate Mormon feminism in terms of the broader feminist movement within Abrahamic theism. feminist theology and philosophy of religion has rejected the androcentric theology that was developed by the men of the theistic traditions. In part, this means that the concept of God was associated with the concept of disembodied reason, where this implies the exclusion of emotion. This notion of dispassionate and disembodied reason is associated with masculinity, of course, while passion and embodiment are associated with femininity. These connections are then used by this tradition to justify patriarchy. They are also used to justify analytic philosophy's ignorance of the context of discovery in doing epistemology. But this approach to reason and the nature of divinity is a mistake, according to feminist philosophers and theologians. There's no such thing as a disembodied knower. Emotion and reason are not diametrically opposed, and different contexts give rise to different ways of seeing the world. So clearly, embodiment plays an important role in the general feminist approach to theology and philosophy of religion. Given that Mormonism embraces God's embodiment and the materiality of spirit, it would seem that it is tailor-made for a feminist approach. And indeed, Mormon feminist theologians such as Margaret Toscano recognize this strength in Mormonism. Consider the following quotation from her famous book, Strangers in Paradox, co-authored by Paul Toscano. "A theology of a God of flesh and glory provides a model preserving binary opposites but refusing to favor one component over the other or to link the so-called less favorable component with the female. If God is both body and spirit, then we may believe that both are equally necessary and valuable." However, it is also clear that Toscano embraces the gender binary, where this is the assumption that each person has one and only one of the two genders, male and female. I should make a passing note here. I'm critiquing Margaret's early work, but her more recent work, some of which hasn't been published, has actually gotten beyond this. And so I'm going to have to include another part of this paper to address those. But I only found out about her more recent work in the last week. So the passage continues, "For us, God is not only flesh and glory, but also male and female. We disagree with those who assert that avoiding sexism means picturing God as being beyond gender and sexuality. A picture of God beyond all categories and relations encourages the very spirit-matter dichotomy which has denigrated women and sex. In our view, the more salutary doctrine is one that sees God as spirit and body, male and female. For this reason, we have come to accept both a male God and a female God, each of whom is simultaneously transcendent and immanent." It's a wonderful passage. Notice that until the last sentence, it's compatible with a non-binary but nevertheless gendered God. But the last sentence seems to commit Toscano to the view that the gods and each of us has one and only one gender, where the options are only male and female exclusively and exhaustively. I think that this view is problematic once someone accepts the possibility of a binary trans person. For example, take myself. The difference between someone like myself that identifies as a woman in the other gender that from what I was assigned, and thus somebody who is binary, and a transgender person that is non-binary is just a matter of degree. In fact, when I first came out, I came out as non-binary due to some ambiguity in my feelings. Over time, after socially and beginning to medically transition, I realized that my feelings were really far on the female side of the spectrum for the most part. But these feelings are a matter of degree. And so the validation of binary trans folk inevitably leads to the validation of non-binary trans folk as well. I should mention something about being non-binary. There's a lot of different ways that people identify when they're non-binary. You might identify as androgyne. You might identify as agender. You might just identify as non-binary. Also, genderqueer is a very common term as well. Really, this shouldn't be a surprise. The body and its emotions are all a matter of degree. So once we focus on the body, we leave the realm of the binary and enter the realm of the analog. Connecting gender to one's sexual embodiment cries out for a linear approach rather than a binary approach. It seems to me that a Mormon feminism that takes embodiment seriously should reject the gender binary. Instead, a Mormon feminist approach to gender and embodiment should allow that being male and female is a matter of degree, with various combinations being possible in a similar way to biological sex, which of course is also not binary in the sense of being mutually exclusive and collectively exhaustive. Moreover, the biological is in constant flux. It is open-ended, unpredictable. Even with the theory of evolution, you can't predict what the next mutation is going to be. And so the dynamic picture of living organisms that emerges doesn't fit well with the claim that gender is eternal, as it was interpreted earlier on in this paper. Indeed, it seems to suggest that we might consider sex and gender to be subject to constant change due to the impermanent nature of embodiment. So starting from the position of non-binary trans folk, the Mormon emphasis on divine and human embodiment can be quite affirming. It's all a matter of degree with bodies, and this is exactly what non-binary individuals feel applies to gender, to their genders in particular. At this point, one might ask, should feminists and other progressive Mormons accept the claim that gender is eternal? Perhaps surprisingly, I don't think that the answer to this question matters, since the claim itself can be interpreted in so many different ways. For example, as we saw above, one could interpret it to be about Platonic universals, and this would say nothing about anyone's particular gender. Indeed, it could be that masculinity and femininity exist as Platonic ideals, and yet we all have a mixture of these characteristics to varying degrees. Or one could agree that gender is eternal and claim that gender is an eternal, multidimensional spectrum. The interesting question isn't whether to accept or reject the language of the proclamation. I think the interesting question is whether there is a non-arbitrary rationale for interpreting it in an anti-feminist, anti-queer, and anti-trans manner. So let me summarize my arguments. Given that one purpose of the proclamation was to give a non-arbitrary reason to reject gay marriage, there's a big loophole in the document. The loophole is that the language of the document is logically consistent with the valid existence of binary trans folk. And furthermore, one cannot accept the valid existence of binary trans folk without problematizing the sexual orientation of their relationships, including marriages. Of course, this is not how the document is interpreted by the Brethren, but their interpretation lacks a further rationale. It is circular and hence arbitrary. The document is supposed to justify the LDS anti-LGBTQ stance, and yet one must assume an anti-LGBTQ stance in order to interpret it properly. Once we accept the possibility that binary trans folk exist, it's hard to see a principled reason not to slide further down the slope to accept the rest of the queer alphabet soup, since the basis for trans folks' identities are their subjective feelings, and such feelings are a matter of degree. Moreover, the importance of the body in Mormonism suggests again that sex and gender is just a matter of degree and not binary. The LDS claim to have a theological justification for their anti-queer stance fails. The dominant theological paradigm in Mormonism is employed to reject all that fall outside the norms of the cishet patriarchy embodied in LDS practice. However, this paradigm cannot function as it is intended to do, since it doesn't really justify the exclusion of a trans woman like Eri. Eri's existence problematizes the orthodox theology of gender, but also reflection on her existence raises the possibility of an alternative Mormon theology of gender that recognizes it to be dynamic and indeterminate. The Mormon trans community is in a unique position to stand as insiders and outsiders that can articulate an alternative theological view of gender that is LGBTQ plus inclusive. Thank you.
Okay, so we'll take some questions, and we'll, because of Sunstone really wants to record this, and we're going to have you speak into a mic. So we're going to encourage dialogue, but we'd like to have it recorded to use that to teach in the future.
Thank you. It was an excellent presentation. I appreciate the explanation of standpoint theory because it's something that I've never actually studied, but it makes a lot of sense to me. I check all of the boxes in terms of empowerment or privilege or whatever, being straight, white, male, American, whatever, all of those. And so something that I really like about standpoint theory that you emphasized was people in minority groups are epistemically privileged because it's more natural for them to see the arbitrariness of the dominant knowledge structures. And so I'm deeply attracted to like the liberation theology of the poor, or black liberation, or the trans commentary on YouTube. One of my favorite YouTubers is ContraPoints, if you've seen it or not. But I feel like I've hit against a wall somewhat, because I really appreciate hearing all of these positions. It really expands my world and my understanding, but at no point can I inhabit those positions biologically or culturally in the same way. And so I find I don't know how to kind of make a leap between benefiting from the standpoint theory of being able to understand where people are coming from, but also simultaneously not inhabiting those standpoints. And so I wondered if you had any advice and to kind of how to bridge that gap, maybe, if that question is clear.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so that's a really good question. Thank you so much. So it's important to recognize the following, and that is that although those who are in a marginalized or dominated group might have an easier time seeing the ways in which society is excluding them than those who are in the dominant group. So, for example, people who are disabled, they're a dominated group, right? And on our campus, it's not always as accessible as it could be. But that's not going to be something that able-bodied people even notice, right? However, if they have friends who are disabled and their friends point out to them, hey, it's really hard to get around in these buildings because there's only a few ramps, it's really tough, they can then see it through the eyes of their friends. So this allows that allies could actually understand what's going on, because they have the testimonies of those who are in the marginalized groups that they can look to. But of course, it also puts you in the following position. It's best, or it's most rational for you to trust them over your own sense of the issue, right? So if you know somebody who's trans and they say, you know what, Dave Chappelle's latest program on Netflix is really transphobic, and it didn't seem that way to you as a cisgendered male, most likely you're wrong and you should look into why, right? You should actually take their word for it and try to understand instead of maybe arguing with them about it. That's actually an example taken from a real life case.
And I think that's a really good example. The epistemical conundrum I find myself in is, I believe that's true, like you need to trust that person. If you do look into it and you do study it and still come to a conclusion different from your original conclusion, but still different from your friend's conclusion, does that make sense? Like, because you're not necessarily going to still come to the same conclusion as your friend, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's not that you automatically have to defer to all of your black friends on issues of race, right? It's just that you need to, their opinions should have more weight than your white friends.
So I'm coming at this from like more an activist perspective. Short background, I feel like the LDS Church still hasn't even come into first wave feminism. Women still don't even have the right to vote, right? We're not ordained to the priesthood, and so we don't have our autonomy within the structure. I find within some feminist communities are still stuck in second wave feminism, where they're still holding on to gender essentialist perspectives that speak, oh, look, we're complementary and it's all heteronormative and great. Then you have a few like third wave feminisms going on within the Mormon feminist movement that are actually starting to talk about queer issues. And I feel like what you're talking about now is like fourth wave feminism. So like, how do we get fourth wave feminist ideas like this that I'm wholeheartedly behind in this organization and institution that still doesn't even recognize a simple cis woman's autonomy to be ordained to the priesthood? Where do we go from here to here? Like, how do we make that happen? Sorry, that was a hard question.
That's a good question.
Like, can you just solve the gender problem right now in one question?
Yeah, I don't know. I spent a lot of time in the church as a heterodox Mormon trying to change it. Living as if I were a cis male. I kind of actually gave up, to be honest. And so I actually don't consider myself part of the heterodox, the internal heterodox Mormon community. I'm standing on the outside and making, you know, philosophical critiques of the theology from the outside instead of from the inside. But that's actually, it's not because I think everyone who disagrees with the church on the issues that I disagree with the church on should leave. It's more like, for personal reasons, I kind of had to. It made it easier to come out and transition and all of that, right? I'm not sure that I know what to do to change the church's mind on this, except, actually, I just watched a little bit of Believer, that thing. And I have more hope because, you know, you've got Mormons who seem to be active. The lead singer of Imagine Dragons seems to be an active Mormon, or at least he was, and yet he doesn't take the church's position on LGBTQ issues. Similarly, my students are way more open to those things. When I talk about gay marriage in my classes now, they're much more pro-gay marriage than they were when I first started teaching. So I think the young people are going to, like, they're going to be the change. And so, and also, since fourth wave feminism really hasn't coalesced yet, maybe they're the ones who are going to coalesce it. But what I am arguing in this paper, though, is this. If you pull at the trans string in Mormon theology, it's heteronormativity and it's sexism actually unravel. The connection that I see is this. If you can be transgender, then gender is not quite, it's not fixed the way we thought it was. And if that's the case, then heterosexuality and homosexuality are not fixed as we thought it was, right? Those are actually somewhat flexible too. And if those become flexible, then patriarchy, of course, is gone.
So I'm going to kind of answer, I'm going to follow up another question, because I actually think that you're dead on in, my history is I've been with the ordained women movement from the beginning, and I, as I explain it to family members who just couldn't get on board, I once said, but what if Heavenly Father and Heavenly Mother is a trans woman? Like, what if that? And that is inherently who they are. That is their gender. And instantly they're like, oh, well, then women need the priesthood. Like, that answers it. And so, like, oh, that would make sense, right? Like, so then they can kind of, like, get behind supporting women's ordination. It did a little bit. But my follow-up question to that would be is, how do we create safe enough spaces going forward? I understand your need to, like, personally, I'm an outsider because I've been put on the outside. But how do we, if anyone is continuing to be in the mainstream Mormon church and engaging with our family members that are in the mainstream church, how do we take that knowledge and create the safe enough spaces so that we can have the trans leaders that we need.
I heard a statistic...
Because we don't deserve them right now.
I heard a statistic that if an LGBT teenager, LGBTQ teenager, has just one adult that respects their identity, they're 30% less likely to try to commit suicide. So really what people need, I think, and what I would have liked to have had when I was in the community, was having people who disagree with the church's official policies say that publicly in some way, right? Push back. Not, you don't have to become like I was when I was a heterodox Mormon. I was in everybody's face. I liked contention. I didn't think it was of the devil. But if queer and trans youth can know that there are some adults that support them, that think the way they do, and maybe there are some adults in the community that themselves are queer or trans, that's helpful, right? That's going to help people more than almost, well, at least in terms of the suicide rate and keeping queer people in the church and in the community, that's going to help with that. But I don't know what I think about the gender of, or what the best approach to the God's gender is. I always liked, earlier on in my career, I always liked the fact that Mormonism had embodied deities, right, that do have gender. But at the same time, I don't like that, you know, God the Father, who is at least tangibly running everything, is male. So the idea of a trans God is actually pretty attractive to me, and I'm interested in like exploring that. Of course, what I would want to do is avoid what, if I were doing Mormon theology, I would want to avoid just going down the agender route, which you get in traditional theology a lot, right? Because, I mean, strictly speaking, in Catholic theology and in most mainline Protestant theology, God doesn't have a gender. In the Northern European mainline churches, like the Lutheran Church in Sweden, there are calls for using gender-neutral pronouns to refer to God. They have like official gender-neutral pronouns that they use in Sweden. So I think Mormonism should keep its uniqueness and look into, you know, ways that don't merely try to get beyond gender entirely, which some people argue for. I actually, as a trans person, I think gender's important. It's not something that I want to get beyond. It's something that I want to live authentically in a way that is consonant with how I feel and not with how people expect me to be. So I wouldn't want to eliminate gender entirely, or at least eliminate the possibility for people to identify with genders. But I would also want there to be the possibility that people don't identify with any gender and call themselves agender, right? So it seems to me that a God that is like gender fluid might be actually sort of a more all-inclusive kind of image of God.
Well, you just touched on something that I want to talk about that was referred to earlier. Jokingly, woman who's leaving said, can you solve the problem of gender, you know, men and women and whatever? And I would propose that the problem, if that's what we want to call it, the differences between men and women and gay and straight and transgender and all these so-called labels, is what God or they, that's how I refer to God, they want, as part of our ability to learn and grow. That if we were all the same, if we didn't have gender, just like if we didn't have different races, we would lose the ability to face that challenge of learning how to deal with power structures and overcome those differences and learn to love one another. I mean, 150 years ago, we were dealing with whether to let women vote or whether to have blacks as slaves and categorize them as subhuman. And then we've had to face those challenges and deal with them ongoing as an opportunity for growth. And I think God, they want there to be differences, to give us the opportunity to see, you know, you have power, you need to learn to let it go and share it and acknowledge these people who have been powerless for whatever reason as part of your need to grow, to become like us. And so we may have this idea that maybe we can achieve this nirvana where there's no differences. I don't think that's what God wants. I think God wants us to be different and learn to love those differences. And I think if we could change this attitude of, oh, if we could just get rid of these differences, to how can we celebrate the differences, that's closer to what God has invited us to do as human beings and not see it as a problem.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. So that's my only comment on that, is I agree with.
I think a major complication in the Proclamation on the Family and all of our discussions about trans issues is the fact that for about a century there have been medical options of hormone therapy and surgery to address this issue. And I think in the Proclamation on the Family and in your own presentation, there's been an absence of comment about millennia of cultural realities in Asia, in the Oceania, in Africa, of third gender, mm-hmm. where you had societies very different from one another, unconnected with one another for the most part, who had a binary sense of male, a binary sense of female, and a fluid sense of third gender. And how do you incorporate that into the perspectives that you've provided today?
So I didn't, you're right, I didn't touch on that fact. In order to address it, I need to say something about what I think about the nature of gender. So one view that you could have about the nature of gender, and I think a lot of conservative Christians would have this kind of view, that is that gender is something essential. There are certain characteristics that come along with it, and so if you are of that gender, you're at least normatively supposed to exhibit those characteristics, and if you don't, you kind of fail to be that gender the way you're supposed to be. There's also the opposite view that you get in both queer theory but also in feminist theory, that gender is a social construct different from sex, biological sex. And it's something that is mostly a free-floating social construct. Most of it's arbitrary. In fact, almost all of it's arbitrary, right, according to this view. And it's arbitrarily imposed on us in order to impose a gender regime that dominates half the population, and actually maybe more if you include trans folk as well. I think that both of those views have got to be wrong, and I actually opt for an alternative view that you could see as a middle position. I usually don't like doing that, just going for the middle, because it's somehow supposed to be the better position. But in this case, I do think that we have to take some intrinsic biological inclinations into account when we're accounting for gender, as well as take into account the fact that we construct it socially in different ways with different cultures. So you mentioned some cultures that have different ways of handling gender, and that it's still present all over the planet. You know, Hawaii, Tonga, I think, India, Pakistan, Iran, all of those places, Thailand, obviously, and also Native American tribes like the Navajo, who have five genders. And then if you were to look at like sort of the biology of gender, read some of the literature on that, you'd see that one of the top feminist biologists of gender Anne Fausto Sterling argues that just based on the sort of scientific distribution of how biological sex goes, there's about five genders. It seems to me that there's something there in us biologically that is, you know, in a way determining kind of how we feel about our gender, whether we feel okay with it. Notice that those of you who are cisgender probably don't have gender dysphoria like somebody who's transgender, right? And so you don't notice the fact that your subjective feelings about gender are actually affecting how you reside in your gender. It seems to me that what's happening then is that you've got these intrinsic inclinations that we then construct different ways of understanding that on top of those inclinations. And some cultures do that in a rather permissive way, trying to allow for a diversity of gender expressions and identities. But others, like increasingly over time historically, the Judeo-Christian, well, the Christian tradition at least, has tried to focus on the two dominant genders and reduce everything to those and to make the outliers actual, you know, they're deviants of some sort, right? So I actually think, yeah, I think the fact that that not all cultures pick a binary for how they construct gender is a really important fact. It shows that gender is at least in part constructed. But at the same time, I agree with Mark. I wouldn't want to live in a world where everybody's expected to be perfectly androgynous, because I really do want to, I mean, I'm constantly buying dresses because I like them. I mean, I want to wear them. I like the material. I like the way they look. There's something about femininity that attracts me. There's something about masculinity that sometimes repulses me. So it seems to me that that's a natural thing. And in order to have what I would call gender autonomy, which is the ability to have control over your own gender, to decide that, to be the one who decides your gender identity, I think that needs to allow for the possibility of a wide diversity. That's why it's okay with me that Facebook has 70 genders, even though I think that a lot of them are probably just arbitrarily constructed by kids on Instagram. But what matters there is that they're no longer being told what their gender is. Instead, they're constructing it themselves. And in doing that, they're liberated, because the gender regime can only oppress you if you let them tell you what you are.
Do we have time? Yeah. Okay. First, I just want to say thank you. I feel like your talk was incredibly detailed in a way that I don't have patience for with LDS doctrine, and I just really appreciate your talk. You kind of just answered my question, but I think I still have questions about it, which is I'm in academia in a PhD program where I find that queer theory takes like the forefront, and I struggle with queer theory for similar reasons that you were saying around how it's almost like there's these two binaries that we're fitting in the gender discussion around whether it's completely biological and there's biological influences, or there's this, or it's completely socialized and it just doesn't seem to make sense for either. And I'm curious, I think for you, what your opinion is on queer theory, although you answered that a little bit, how you navigate that within being in academia, and just what your thought is around whether queer theory has a space around in Mormon doctrine around the socialization piece, or if it's something that needs to be more integrated with the idea that there's biological and socialized aspects to gender.
Mm-hmm. I think that queer theory, or at least queer approaches to theology, definitely have a place in Mormonism. I think Taylor Petrie's article Toward a Post-Heterosexual Mormon Theology is like a brilliant starting point for that. I have maybe some very minor criticisms of his work, but yeah, I do think that queer theory has that place in in Mormon theology. I want to see more queer people and people who are doing work on queer studies doing work in Mormon studies. That would be a great thing. Recently, I submitted a paper to the Mormonism section and the queer section at the American Academy of Religion, decided to do a joint session on Mormonism and queer studies, and there weren't enough submissions for a session on that, so I ended up getting bumped over to a different session, right, because there weren't enough people doing that. I think there needs to be more, but the unfortunate thing is that the church keeps doubling down on this issue, and it's causing more and more the young people to leave. At first, they're going to see this queer issue, the queer issues, and say, there's something wrong with this, and they're going to try to be, you know, believing Mormons while at the same time advocating that there's something wrong with it. But that is a hard, as you all know, the Sunstone community knows better than any other community. That's a hard road to take. It's very difficult. It's traumatizing, actually, for some people. So, yeah, so I don't know. I don't know if I fully answered your question. I'm sorry.
Thank you so much. Let's give one last round of applause to your amazing time and presentation.